Everybody here making fun of me this morning because after just 2 days of spring-like weather, I show up at the studio this morning wearing a heavy winter coat. Hey, I'm cold. Sue me. Good mornings, I'm Chris Oaks, and coming up today, Blanchard Valley Health System recently announced they will no longer perform open-heart surgeries. So why are they calling it an enhancement to cardiac care? We'll speak with Dr. Bill Coates. Also this morning, Senator Rob McCauley discusses the significance of SB 215, a bill that he co-sponsored and which recently cleared the Ohio Senate that proponents say will keep foreign dark money out of campaigns for ballot issues in the state. And we have details on March programs and events at the Hancock Historical Museum, including a look back at law enforcement vehicles through the decades and a classic movie night. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. So here's something that may make you feel better if you are stressing out today. You know, first thing in the morning, you're rolling out of bed. If it's been a stressful week, you know, it is Wednesday. It's like, man, the week is only halfway over. I mean, you can look at it that way, or you can look at it as, hey, the week is halfway over. But, you know, if you're having one of those stressful weeks, you are not alone. This is kind of interesting. New study out of North Carolina State University, NC State. Younger adults say that they look worse on stressful days, especially if they feel like they lack control. The study examined data from 107 adults between the ages of 18 to 36. Participants were asked about the amount of stress they felt, how much control they felt they had over their lives, and how old they felt that they looked. On days when the people in the study reported experiencing higher levels of stress than they normally did, they also reported looking and feeling older. We've all experienced that, right? You feel stressed out. How often have you said this to yourself or maybe to your spouse or whatever? I feel old, you know? I'm too young to feel this old. The leader of the study, Professor Siobhan Newport, said this phenomenon only true on days when study participants also reported not just stress, but the feeling that they had less control over their lives than they normally did. And of course, it was a stress study because chronic stress over time can have adverse health effects. But it was interesting nonetheless. I guess the main takeaway when I saw this, the main takeaway is that if you feel old because you are stressed, if it's been a stressful day, stressful week or what have you, and you're just feeling old, you are not alone. And it is not uncommon, according to the study. A couple of other items here, a few other items from the list of most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your midweek Wednesday morning started. We know how much food prices at the grocery store have gone up in recent years, so much so that people sometimes say they can no longer afford many of their favorite foods. But take heart, because we'll always have banana bread. It's true, while inflation has impacted most grocery store staples, bananas seem to stay affordable through all of the ups and downs of everything else. It says here, not just through this period of rising prices, according to Axios, they did a deep dive into this, bananas have remained a historically recession-proof food. Of all things, bananas. In January, the average price per pound... Here's the thing that... I mean, this is interesting, but what jumped out at me when I saw this story on the Newswire, this is based on a report from Axios. Who was the reporter at Axios who was just probably walking through the grocery store and noticed that bananas were still relatively cheap and say, I need to do a story on this? Who was this reporter who said, I need to do a story on bananas? Anyway, according to this report, bananas have remained historically recession-proof. In January, the average price per pound for bananas was just under 62 cents. At Trader Joe's, banana costs as little as 19 cents each. And this is because labor costs are low and the crop yield is very large. Bananas also spoil quickly, which means that the fruit is always priced to sell. And I guess that makes sense. You could charge more, but if it just sits there and rots on the shelf, that doesn't do anybody any good. So that is interesting. Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament gets underway today in, what is it? Is it Wisconsin, Minnesota? Where is this? The Target Center in Minneapolis. It has been sold out for weeks. Tickets for the Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament have been sold out for weeks on the strength, of course, of Caitlin Clark. If you want to watch the opening round games of the Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament, they will be there. Two games this evening, and those will both be streamed on Peacock. The championship game on Sunday will be on CBS, and all of the rest of the games will be on the Big Ten Network. Of course, Ohio State first takes the floor on Friday, and we will have that game right here on WFIN as well. It will be a 12:45 tip, I think, or 12:30, something like that. It's an afternoon game. It's the early game. So anyway, we will have that game on Friday. But I thought this was kind of interesting. Caitlin Clark obviously is the big draw. And the numbers are in from this past weekend's game between Iowa and Ohio State, in which number 22 set the all-time NCAA scoring record. Nearly 3.4 million people tuned into Fox to watch the game. More people watched her final regular season game than the Boston Celtics Golden State Warriors game on ABC the same day. How about that? I mean, if you'd have said 10 years ago that a women's college basketball game would beat out an NBA game in terms of most viewers, I think people would have said, you're nuts. But that's exactly what happened on Sunday. The game was the most watched women's basketball game since at least 2010 and shattered this season's previous high mark of almost 1.9 million viewers when Ohio State and Iowa played back in January. So that was the last time that there was an audience that size or anywhere close to that size. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Iowa and Ohio State could be on a collision course to meet for a third time this Sunday in the championship game if the stars align. So who knows how it is. Wouldn't be as big as this past Sunday's game because obviously she's already set the scoring record. So that was one of the big draws. And of course, this is her final season, announcing her decision to head to the WNBA following the end of her Iowa career. And you wonder if she's going to be able to draw that many viewers to the WNBA. I know the WNBA is hoping so. This remains to be seen. Follow-up to a story that we had a few days ago. We were talking about this, I think, on Friday. The iconic New Jersey restaurant booth that was featured in HBO's Sopranos finale has brought in big bucks at auction. Yeah, we were talking about this on Friday. The burgundy booth with the yellow formica top where Tony Soprano sat with his family before the screen suddenly went black in 2007. You remember the series finale. Holston's in Bloomfield, New Jersey is the restaurant where that was filmed. And they put the booth up for auction on eBay last week because they are renovating the restaurant and they actually were hoping to use the proceeds from selling the iconic booth to help pay for the renovations to the restaurant. They're updating it and all of that. So they're removing the booth, and rather than just scrap it, they went ahead and sold it on eBay. They were hoping to get 10 grand. You remember on Friday we mentioned the bidding was like at 13 grand. The final total, more than $82,000. $82K. not only did the restaurant say they were hoping to get some money for the renovations of the restaurant, this is more than enough to pay for all of the planned renovations of the restaurant. They got it paid for. And, of course, lucky buyer is getting a piece of TV history. Don't know who bought it, but went for $82,000 plus. As I mentioned on Friday, I think eventually I'm hoping it ends up like in the Smithsonian or something. It just seems like that's one of those iconic pieces of TV, like Fonzie's leather jacket or, you know, Dorothy's slippers from The Wizard of Oz, something like that. Or Mr. Rogers' cardigan sweater. It belongs in the Smithsonian as part of an Americana, but it went to a private buyer, at least for now. And lastly, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, think about this. For the Lenten season, new data from the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey shows that the nation's least religious big city is Seattle. The least religious big city in the country. Seattle has the fewest number of churchgoers among the nation's 15 largest metropolitan areas. I just thought that was interesting. The numbers show around 64% of Seattle residents never attend religious services or go less than once per year on average. San Francisco is ranked the second least religious, with 63% never attending services. Boston rounds out the bottom three with 56% attendance. The survey conducted in January and February of this year ahead of the Lenten season. There you go, some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Mostly cloudy today, a high around 50, becoming partly cloudy tonight, a low around 40. A three-vehicle crash a little west of Findlay sent one person to the hospital. The crash happened at the intersection of U.S. 224 and County Road 139 and involved a box truck, a garbage truck, and a school bus with no students on board. The Hancock County Sheriff's Office says a 39-year-old driver of the garbage truck crashed into the back of the box truck that was slowing down a turn while traveling east on U.S. 224. Both of the vehicles overturned, and then the box truck hit a school bus that was stopped at the stop sign on County Road 139. The sheriff's office said the driver of the garbage truck was treated on the scene, and a juvenile passenger in the box truck was taken to a hospital with minor injuries. Get more on the crash in the story on our website. The U.S. Postal Service is offering a $250,000 reward for information on the murder of a postal worker in Ohio.
Warren police found a postal worker Saturday afternoon with a gunshot wound inside his van. Police say the man had been shot by a suspect in another vehicle while he was inside his U.S. postal van. Warren police say they believe this was a targeted attack. The FBI is assisting the investigation.
I'm Yolanda Harris.
Ohio U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown will host Wood County Sheriff Mark Vosselution as his guest at the State of the Union on Thursday. Senator Brown joined Sheriff Vosselution on a trip to the southern U.S. border in November, and they're working together to ensure that law enforcement have the tools and support they need to keep communities safe and address the fentanyl crisis devastating Ohio communities. Get more in the story on our website. This is Community Read Month at the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library, and since Hancock County is in the path of totality for the upcoming solar eclipse, the library has chosen, in lieu of an author visit, to invite the Imagination Station to share in the Community Read and eclipse excitement.
They're bringing 12 different science stations and their inflatable star lab, which we're going to set up underneath the skylight that day. So it'll just be science all over the library.
That's Library Director Sarah Clevidence. The event will be held on March 16th. Get more details in this story on our website. And don't forget, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Get to our cover story here this morning. You recall last week, Blanchard Valley Health System announced that they will no longer be performing open heart surgeries. Dr. Bill Coase is with us from Blanchard Valley Health System to talk more about that decision. And first, I want to ask the question that we raised when we were teasing the fact that we'd have you in here this morning, this announcement that no more open heart surgeries, but It sounded sort of like conflicting information because you present it as an enhancement to cardiovascular care.
Well,
so it sounds it, those two things sound strange together.
Great point. So what we would be saying is that we're going to be expanding the services that we're doing in heart surgery. There are gaps in care that have become, as we become more sophisticated with medicine in general, how we can treat congestive heart failure, reading or looking at CAT scans to look at what the coronary arteries look at, the same way with MRI. So there's lots of different things that are being done that we're hoping that this will allow us to expand those parts. We are not going to be doing open heart, and there's a lot of reasons related to that. One, with the new technologies that are occurring, many things are being done catheterization, and instead of open heart, opening them up, and they become quite sophisticated. Valves that were done routinely back when we were doing 100 or so cases a year are now being done in cath labs in very sophisticated places. It's really good for patients because they don't have to have their chest opened up.
Right.
But you need to be able to do a significant volume of that to keep your techniques and things up. And that's what we've seen. The number of cases has dramatically gone down over the last several years, and that was part of the decision.
So is it an economic decision, at least in part?
Well, it's economic from a standpoint of getting people, of being able to have, in an open heart or really in neurosurgery or orthopedics, it's become much of a team. So you need not just in addition to a really a surgeon, what we would call a cardiac surgeon, mm-hmm. you need perfusionists, you need specialized anesthesia people. There's a whole team that's involved in that. So economically,
yeah.
that does become part of it. But it's more so related to the sophistication and the time. There are regulations written by the High Department of Health, an expectation that you do so many cases, and we are well below that just because of demand, because of where they can be done in the cath lab and things like I talked about.
So as you were mentioning, it's a good thing for patients that open heart surgery is just no longer as, I don't want to say as prevalent as, I guess, what it once was.
Great point. That is for sure, that we are not doing surgeries now that would have been done, let's say, when we opened a program 20 years ago. They now can be done sometimes by stenting, but they can also be done by other technologies. And so from a patient standpoint, yes,
yeah.
having your chest cracked is a big deal.
Right.
And so, again, that would be part of what the decision was of how we've done this.
That being said, open heart surgery is not necessarily obsolete now. So for those cases where it is needed, what happens?
So we have arranged, and what we did was, we've been looking at this for the past several months, year or so, of what we could do to partner, and we have been able from our institution here to transfer a lot of cases of the things that I've talked about. So we are going to be partnering with Ohio State. That's where our physicians, it's not so much preferred as this is where the relationships had been developed. Mm-hmm. And so we have been talking to them about being able to make sure we can expedite a transfer process if it would occur. We're also going to be, as we talk to them, the expansion of the things that I talked about, one of the gaps that's certainly here in Hancock County is vascular surgery. So we're planning on working with them. Now, that would be aneurysms of other arteries or blood vessels that would need to be taken care of, people that have dialysis. That's been a gap. It's recruiting has been, when you go back to the economics, part of just being able to find all kinds of physicians is related to retention policy and having access to technology and those things. And so we think Ohio State will really be able to help us do that, too.
Does this kind of speak to this transformation of, you know, modern healthcare, where your local community hospital or health system is no longer, or in the future will no longer be all things to all people, but will be focusing on the most primary, most sought after procedures, and then farming more of that stuff out? I mean, we're going to see more of this type of, I don't want to say specialization, but
well, I think I think your point again is really well taken, and I think part of it is related to specialization. If you take any of the different modalities in medicine, mm-hmm. ophthalmology, orthopedics, neurosurgery, there are things using neurosurgery. The gamma knife is something millions of dollars to be able to do that for brain tumors. Those aren't things that community hospitals are going to be able to do. And I think then the recruiting issue of a lack of not just specialists, the physicians, all healthcare providers is causing that. And the biggest thing, though, is technology, being able to have access to those things. I think you are going to see much more vertical relationships or those things developing that we will be able to transfer. It's going to be inconvenient for some people. I think overall, it's as time goes on, we will get used to that. We've had really great quality from a standpoint of looking at the community. We want to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. And then I think these bigger places will also, they become much more focused in what they're doing, standardization. They have several ORs, and it just gets to be how things are taken care of.
And you mentioned the technology. It's so rapidly changing. It's a lot to keep up on when you are trying to be full service, all things to all people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, back to whether you look at that at economics or not, you have to utilize your capital about what you're doing.
Yeah.
Now, that always becomes somewhat of a factor, and I think we're going to see that. Your question, we're going to see that evolve over the next few years, much more so.
Which, and again, it's difficult to peer into your crystal ball, and we certainly don't want to put any words in your mouth or anything with respect to that. But can you see similar partnerships like this, similar consolidation in other areas moving forward?
I think that's, a great question, Chris. And when we look at our community strategy, I mean, we're here for the community. We want to make sure we provide the best care and what we can do. Our strategy is we want to remain independent so we can make these kind of decisions. Mm-hmm. If you're in a system, well, you would be more told what to do. But part of our strategy is also to have partnerships. So we have partnerships with Toledo. We have partnerships with Nationwide Children's. We now have a partnership with Ohio State. We have partnerships with Ohio Health at Riverside in different modalities of what we do. I think we will continue to look at those opportunities, and it's also related to your personnel and the number of people you have and those sort of things.
Again, the announcement, I think when a lot of people heard this, initially it sounded like a negative, but again, when you look at it broadly in the big picture of things, it doesn't...
Well, we feel that way. We feel that, again, looking at it from the patient standpoint of where you're going to be able to, into the future, get the best care, that being able to broaden the things that we can take care of. Maybe we'll prevent people from even heart care with more prevention and more things that we can do to pick up diseases early.
Yeah, being the best the best system, offering the best care for the most people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Again, Dr. Bill Coe, Blanchard Valley Health System, with us this morning. We've got a link up for more information about this change. And is this effective immediately? I mean, no more.
We have a plan. We are essentially not going to be doing open heart, but we have a plan over the next several months to accommodate all of those things.
All right. Yep. Dr. Coe, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Last week, the Ohio Senate passed SB 215. It is a bill co-sponsored by Senator Rob McCauley, which proponents say will keep foreign dark money out of campaigns for ballot issues in the state. Senator McCauley is with us on the line this morning. Senator, thanks very much for taking the time. First of all, we appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
As we mentioned, this would restrict, SB 215 would restrict dark money contributions from foreign entities in ballot issue campaigns in Ohio, such as last year's measure to write women's reproductive rights into the state constitution, right? This is the type of measure that you are targeting with this proposed restriction, correct?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the subject matter we're targeting. Frankly, there was so much money thrown into those ballot initiatives that it's hard to say whether this would have impacted that result at all. But what it revealed was an alarming trend, is that there would be what some would call a loophole in Ohio's law that you can spend foreign money or money from foreign nationals in ballot campaigns, even though we've had a prohibition on the books on state law for candidate elections since 2000.
So how much money are we talking about? Because initially, some folks may hear this and say, well, is this a solution in search of a problem? Is this really, how much money is really going into these campaigns from foreign entities?
Well, there's one fund in particular that we've been able to isolate that has direct ties to foreign money, and that's been reported by the AP and other news outlets. The 1630 fund has been tied to a Swiss billionaire named Hans-Jörg Bies, who has put nearly $250 million with a B dollars into that fund since 2016. That fund put nearly $14 million into the Ohio Issues campaigns last year.
Opponents call this the Sore Losers Act. Would we have this? I mean, I know you mentioned that this is not necessarily targeting any specific ballot issue, past or present, but would we have seen this if, say, that abortion issue had not passed?
I still think we would, because, look, I think all Ohioans should agree on a bipartisan basis that we don't want to have foreign money impacting or influencing our elections. We generally don't want foreign influence on our elections at all.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can have foreign influence to the tune of $14 million, or nearly $14 million, it shouldn't matter where that money came from. And it shouldn't matter what side of the argument that money was on. We should all be able to universally agree that's not how we want our elections to be run or influenced in the state of Ohio, and we need to close the loophole. Like I said, for candidate elections, this has been on the books since 2000. At the federal level, it's been on the books since 1972 against foreign influence in candidate elections.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a new topic. It's just these groups, their new playbook that they've found a loophole with, they're beginning to pump millions of dollars into these issues elections all across the country. This is not isolated to Ohio.
So how is it? How is it that we had this loophole in the first place? Why was this just a complete oversight? Or,
well, arguably, it's not even a loophole. In 2021, the Ohio Elections Commission actually published an opinion. They're kind of the oversight board for our elections. They actually published an advisory opinion saying that they thought the existing prohibitions on foreign spending in elections covered issues campaigns.
Mm.
Nevertheless, the 1630 fund decided anyway that they would throw $14 million into the state of Ohio for those issues campaigns. And oh, by the way, they've already given in 2024 as well. We're just telling you 2023 numbers.
Yeah.
So the fact that they are still doing it in spite of the regulator's opinion that they cannot led us to believe that we need to have legislative action.
So to lay this out specifically and make sure that it is explicit. Why limit it to just foreign contributions? I mean, why not include out-of-state special interest groups in this as well? I mean, that's one thing that we've heard time and time again, especially when we talk about these constitutional measures, that we don't want out-of-state groups coming in and telling Ohio how to rewrite their constitution.
Yeah, that's a question that we get asked an awful lot, but there's... everybody's heard of the case Citizens United, and everybody's heard of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Right.
The First Amendment obviously protects political speech, free speech generally. Political speech through Supreme Court precedent has been extended to citizens' ability to participate in political speech wherever it may be situated in the United States. And Citizens United, that court case, actually said that corporations have the ability to participate in political speech just as individuals would. So I think even if we tried to say out-of-state domestic dark money that was headquartered in the United States could not do this type of activity, I believe it would be swiftly struck down in a federal court case.
So if that raises constitutional issues, as far as that goes, really it sounds like all you can do with respect to that is try to shed light on it when out-of-state money comes in to try and influence Ohio elections.
Yeah, exactly. And that's through the campaign finance disclosure. So Ohio already requires for ballot campaigns that the official ballot campaigns need to list their donors. And that's how we can see that the 1630 Fund was playing in these elections, because the 1630 Fund was donating directly to these ballot campaigns. Yeah. And then, of course, it's just following the money back through resources that we have to be able to find out the 1630 Fund has received a huge sum of money. Like I said, nearly $250 million from one billionaire in Switzerland since 2016.
Now, we mentioned that SB 215 cleared the Ohio Senate last week. What is its future? Have you talked with your counterparts in the Ohio House? Are they likely to pass this as well? Does it have support from the governor, that kind of thing? What's the future of this?
I hesitate to speak for the governor, but I would say I'd be hard pressed to believe he would have any opposition to this.
Mm-hmm.
The Ohio House talked a little bit briefly with some of the representatives locally. It seems to have support, but hard to predict in some cases what's going to happen right now in the legislature. I hope they'll take it up because, like I said, this should be something that on a bipartisan basis, Ohioans should be able to agree upon.
Yeah. While we have you here, I do want to ask you one question on a different note. Of course, yesterday was Super Tuesday. Presidential race looks like it is all but settled. The headlines this morning are that Nikki Haley is going to withdraw from the Republican race. So it is all academic at this point before Ohioans even get the chance to weigh in the primary process. Some have suggested that we need to move our primary up to Super Tuesday or even earlier because the seventh largest state in the country should have a say. What say you?
Well, actually, it's interesting the history behind that. We used to have it earlier, and then we moved it back so we could be an all-or-nothing state under some of the bylaws at the Republican National Convention. I believe that happened before Kasich ran. I think it's worth a discussion to see where we think we should fit in all of this. You are right. Ohio is the seventh largest state. We would like it to have a little bit more of a voice. But let's also remember, Donald Trump is a very popular figure, and I don't think anybody was surprised that he was going to have it wrapped up this early in the election cycle. This is kind of an anomaly when you look at things as far as presidential elections go. And it's not uncommon that an election would kind of drag out into March based on history over the past 20, 30 years. So I think that we shouldn't rush to a decision based off of this. This is largely due to Donald Trump's popularity and the fact that people want to see the America First agenda return to the White House.
Again, State Senator Rob McCauley with us this morning. We have more information about SB 215, everything else going on in the state legislature, linked up at our webpage, goodmornings.net. Senator, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Information that makes a difference. Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Now, this may be one of the most bizarre stories that I have ever heard. And as you know, our stock in trade in the broken news is highlighting bizarre stories. But this takes the cake. Apparently, there is a band in Nashville called Lorona. Now, I've never heard of this band. I don't know anything about the band Lorona. But they are making headlines because the lead singer of Lorona has been accused of poisoning the bassist for the band with estrogen. Dosing the bassist with estrogen. The motive, to steal the bassist's girlfriend. Apparently, the band posted about the incident on their Instagram account. Diego, the lead singer of the band, was lacing his bandmates' supplements, nutritional supplements, with estrogen in an attempt to make him more feminine and thus less attractive to his girlfriend. The bassist, known as Styx, apparently suffered from physical problems relating to the estrogen, and that's when the plot was uncovered. The band goes on to say he has been attempting, Diego's been attempting to force a transition onto him for the last 5 months in the hopes that it would give him the opportunity to swoop in once he looked stronger and more manly in comparison. Sounds like a brilliant plan. I can't believe that these guys are in a band and not, you know, like running a Fortune 500 company. It is unclear if any criminal charges will be filed, but I am assuming that the band is looking for a new lead singer. I'm guessing that they're in the market for a new lead singer. That is just bizarre. It's just bizarre. Elsewhere in the broken news this morning, from the international file in Japan, a school principal has been fired and will lose his pension for stealing 50 cents worth of coffee. Here's the story. 59-year-old school principal, and I don't know the principal's name. Even if the story gave the name, I probably wouldn't be able to pronounce it, so I won't even try. 59-year-old principal was using a self-service coffee maker in the school and poured himself a large coffee while only paying for the regular size coffee. Regular coffees sell for about 73 cents. Large coffees sell for $1.20. They're not pressing charges, but when the Board of Education learned about the incident, they confronted the principal, who admitted to using the larger cup on several occasions. He was therefore fired for gross misconduct unbecoming of an educational public servant. And he is going to lose his pension, which would have been worth about $133,000. All over a 50 cent difference in the price of a cup of coffee. I don't know. Was it worth it? $133,000 pension gone. As one person pointed out in commenting on this story, you know, he's an older guy, probably could have gotten away with saying he didn't know how to use the machine, but he admitted it. And because he did, he is now out his pension over the whole thing. Wow. That is tough. Some of the other items in the broken news this morning. A man from the Los Angeles area is suing a luxury resort in Las Vegas, claiming a scorpion stung him on his man parts. He's claiming a scorpion stung him where you don't want to be stung if you're a man while he was sleeping. The alleged incident happened at the Venetian Hotel and Casino back in December. The man says he was stung 3 or 4 times, which left him in excruciating pain. Yeah, I would think so. Although 3 or 4 times, I mean, when I was, if I was stung once there by a scorpion, I think I would, he was sleeping at the time, but I think one sting would be enough to wake me up. the man says he is still dealing with the medical issues months later, and he adds that he still had to pay for the hotel room despite what happened. Yeah, I think I'm with him on that. I mean, you know, come on, the least you can do is comp in the room. I mean, whether you believe you are responsible or not legally, I mean, come on, comp the guy the room. Since he was stung in his private parts. Yeah, comp him the room, man. That's... let's see. This is pretty rough. A North Carolina Dunkin' Donuts employee is being accused of shooting at a customer. Union County Sheriff's investigators say they have arrested 18-year-old Ricky Miller, an employee at the Monroe, North Carolina Dunkin' Donuts location. Investigators tell local news reporters the victim had been upset. The victim had been upset about the quality of service or lack thereof and demanded a refund. And that's when they say Mr. Miller followed the man in his car and then pulled alongside the victim and fired several shots into his pickup truck. I can't imagine why he would have complained about the service. It seems like they are so customer centered on their service philosophy there at this Dunkin' location. Can't imagine there would have been any problems with customer service. The man was not injured, but the pickup truck was heavily damaged with bullet holes. Mr. Miller now is facing several felony charges, and again, I'm assuming is probably out of a job. Or maybe he's been promoted. I don't know what the corporate policy is there. Dunkin' Donuts. Let's see. And, how about this? In South Jersey, police in one New Jersey town are on the lookout for a guy who dunked his head in a store's open pickle barrel. They don't know who it is, but whoever it is, the guy left a sour taste in the mouths of workers at Heritage's dairy store in Glassboro, about 20 miles south of Philadelphia. Store workers say an unknown young man walked into the store and with a splash dunked his head into the store's pickle barrel, costing the store about $52 in now spoiled pickles. Police have posted the delinquent's photo online. They declined to post video because they are thinking that the guy, whoever it is, would probably enjoy the attention. So, my first reaction in seeing this story is, there's a store with a pickle jar, an open pickle? There's still a store in America with an open pickle barrel? I thought that went out in the 19th century. But they probably don't have a pickle barrel there anymore now. They want to rethink that. And finally, in the broken news this morning, if you haven't seen this video, you got to go online and look it up. Drivers on the interstate in Cleveland were forced to hold their horses, literally, when a pair of police horses trotted against traffic on a stretch of Interstate 90 in downtown Cleveland. It is amazing video. The traffic cam video, you can see the horses just trotting along the wrong way of Interstate 90 downtown Cleveland. The horses weave through slowing traffic, eventually bringing it to a complete standstill. An Ohio Department of Transportation video shows the horses with police officers eventually following close behind. Mounted officers promptly recovered both horses, ensuring their safety, and no further incidents ensued, according to Cleveland Police Sergeant Wilfredo Diaz. Sergeant Diaz explains the horses are members of the department's mounted division that inadvertently strayed during routine care and exercise. It is quite the video. If you haven't seen it, you got to go and look that up. It is pretty wild. Very humorous. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
When local news breaks, you can hear about it on social media at lightning speed. And while getting you the information fast is important, WFIN will always present the story only after verifying with actual sourced facts. This is WFIN News Director Matt Demchek. Trust the voice that's been covering the news in Findlay and Hancock County for more than 80 years. You can depend on us to get the story right every time. On social media, 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and at 95.5 FM.
Time now for your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. If you are going on a dinner date, on a first date, you want to impress that special someone or someone you hope will be special and score a second date, a new survey has revealed the things you absolutely do not want to do. If you're going on a first date, the things you don't do at dinner if you're hoping for a second date. And at the top of the list, make sure you are not a jerk to the wait staff. That is the biggest dining turnoff in this survey. 2,000 people in the survey were asked to rank 30 dining don'ts. And number one on the list is being rude to your servers. So don't do that if you want to impress someone and score a second date, because that will not do it. Number two on the list, chewing with your mouth open. And don't do that. Talking with your mouth full is number three. And those two things are kind of related. But chewing with your mouth open, number two. Talking with a mouth full is number three. Spitting something back onto the plate was ranked fourth. Yeah, don't do that. That is, even if you're not on a first date, don't do that. That's just gross. I don't care what it tastes like. You just roll with it. Especially on that first date. And picking your teeth rounded out the top five of dining don'ts. No-nos. Maybe you want to just, instead of out eating out, just have a home-cooked meal. 54% in the survey, 54% say having a partner cook a meal for them is a top turn-on. So maybe foregoing dinner out entirely would be the way to go. And if you can't cook, well, that's okay. You can help out afterward. 35% say it's a turn-on if their potential partner cleans up for the cook afterwards. So even if you're not a chef, you can clean up, and that's almost as big a score there. As a matter of fact, 55% of those in the poll say that they would rather eat takeout at home, even on a date, rather than eat out someplace, which I thought was kind of interesting, 55% to 21%. And of course, there you have no waiters to insult, so that's a good thing. Couple of the other things that are definite no-nos if you are eating out that I thought were noteworthy. Ordering food with an unpleasant smell is on the list. Don't do that. And number 30 of 30 on the list, ordering a well-done steak. Time to get an update on what's happening in the month of March at the Hancock Historical Museum. Curator and archivist Joy Bennett is with us in the studio once again. I tell you what, last time we had you here, we were talking about the launch of the new 90s exhibit.
Yes.
At the museum. And boy, since then, it has gotten a lot of press, a lot of attention. People, it seems, are really excited about this.
Yeah, they really are. And I'm happy to see it. The only downside I see is there are so many people who are so upset that the 90s are at the museum. So I'm trying to remove the stigma. Like, just because it's in a museum,
this can't be history.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't mean you're old because we're highlighting your childhood.
I have to think that going in, there was probably not, I mean, as the curator and archivist, I would imagine that there wasn't a whole lot of 90s stuff that was already in the collection at the museum, right?
No, there definitely
was
not.
So where did all of this come from?
I was lucky enough to be able to crowdsource it. We all individually, all the staff, we all brought in stuff that we still had from our childhood. Mm-hmm. We put it on Facebook. We asked our friends. and then we had some volunteers who are just great because they have everything. I won't go so far as to say they're hoarders, but they, if you need something, they'll have it. And so they brought me boxes and boxes of stuff. So I was not at a loss. I was at a loss to find places to put everything.
Yeah. So, how much of this stuff now then becomes part of the collection at the museum. I mean, I would imagine that's kind of how a lot of it happens.
Yes. It starts off with about half of it is outright donated, and then the other half is loaned because everybody's kind of hesitant. They don't always want to give up their stuff.
Right.
And then they realize, okay, it's been at the museum for a while on this exhibit. I don't really need it back. And then they'll donate it.
Yeah.
Unless it's a very...
Probably not using that old Game Boy.
Yeah.
That, you know what I mean?
Well, I actually think the Game Boy will have to be returned.
But maybe some of those fashions we don't necessarily want back.
Yes, okay, the clothes they'll probably tell me I can keep. But yeah, I have a feeling the Game Boy they're going to want back.
And the exhibit is open now anytime regular museum hours to check that out.
Yep, so. Absolutely.
Yeah. A few things happening in the month of March that we want to highlight. You've got a brown bag lunch lecture coming up tomorrow, and this one is really interesting, talking about police vehicles through the decades.
Yes. We are very lucky to work with Tom Davis in a lot of things with Oktoberfest, and he gives tours of the courthouse. He contacted me a while ago saying he wanted to give a lecture at some point on police vehicles. And so I've been scouring the Courier's negative collection, finding different pictures of old police vehicles and going through the collection. And so he's got this great presentation all set up. He's very knowledgeable. And anybody who knows Tom Davis knows he's going to give a great talk.
And this is something that I never really thought about. I mean, we, you know, see the police vehicles every day, and it's something that we, you know, without a second thought. But when you really dig into it, it is quite the evolution of law enforcement transportation.
Oh, absolutely. And he's even going from horses all the way up to modern day, you know, how many horsepower you have in those cars. And he knows everything from the changes in the police lights and the sirens and the additions they added. Mm-hmm. And there were so many different types of cars that got used that just made me laugh when I looked at them.
Yeah. The cars, the equipment that is included in the cars is always interesting as well.
Oh, so, yeah. Yep. I don't think he's getting into that quite as much. He's mostly sticking with the
vehicles themselves.
Yeah.
But I think it probably one influences the other.
Yeah.
I would imagine,
oh, definitely.
In large measure. But anyway, that is happening tomorrow, right?
Yes, at noon at the museum. You don't need to RSVP, just show up, but I guarantee it's going to be packed.
Okay, noon tomorrow for the Brown Bag Lunch Lecture. Also, coming up later on in the month, well, here in just a week or so, a little over a week, we've got Classic Movie Night, and this is a classic movie night. It doesn't get any more classic than this.
That is correct. Yes. On the 15th, we will be showing Casablanca, which is one of my favorite movies. It is not the first time we've showed it, but I have had so many requests. Like, why haven't you shown Casablanca? And I have to say, well, I showed that like 7 years ago. So I figured it was time to bring it back.
Absolutely. Play it again, Sam. You know, that I know that line is not actually in the movie, play it again. That might be an interesting part of the discussion about lines that people remember from movies that aren't actually in movies.
Right. Yeah. That is true. That actually comes from a Woody Allen movie.
Mm-hmm. Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, Claude Rains, Casablanca. And that is March 15th, mentioned. Yeah.
March 15th.
Give us the details on this.
The movie itself will start about 7. I always have some previews and some stuff beforehand. So if you want to get there a little early, you can see the newsreels from 1942.
Very cool.
There's always a little bit of historical information talking about the movie right beforehand and an optional discussion afterwards. We have popcorn, so feel free to bring your own beverage and come on down.
And again, that is a free event.
It is free, yes.
Okay. So again, on the 15th, circle that on the calendar. A little bit later on in the month, you have an event centered around the total solar eclipse.
Yes, much like everyone else in town.
Right.
But it's a big deal for us here. On the 23rd, in the evening, between 5 and 8 p.m., that's a Saturday, we're going to have a family-friendly event with lots of games and crafts, and you'll get to learn a lot about eclipse safety, a little more than just don't look at the sun, but we'll have some information on how to take photos and the best ways to look at it. you know, you can get a free pair of Eclipse safety glasses
until
we run out. Okay. And we also have educational books for the first 50 families that come through. We will be having a lot of groups like the public library, and we'll, of course, have the planetarium from the Parks District, as well as a few other groups. And it's, we're happy to say it's sponsored by the Elks, the Community Foundation, and Heavenly Pizza.
So that is on the 23rd, and again from 5 to 8 p.m. Yep. The evening of the 23rd. Definitely something to circle on the calendar, because this, again, in a historical context, I mean, it's been a long time since this has happened. Yes, I think, what, back in the
Tecumseh.
Yeah, the 1700s, something like that. Not going to happen again for another 75 years. So in a historic context, this is a big deal.
Yes, it is. And we do also have an additional historic connection to eclipses with Hancock County native William Wallace Campbell, who became a scientist and proved Einstein's theory of relativity using eclipses and traveled the world to view them.
Yeah.
So we have an exhibit on that, and we'll have a little more information on that, so you get some history as well as science.
His story is really fascinating. A few years ago, I know the museum highlighted that, and folks may remember we talked with, I think, one of his descendants, one of his members of his family.
Yeah.
Really fascinating story that not a whole lot of people know about, connected right to Finley. Again, Joy Bennett with us from the Hancock Historical Museum. Lots of things going on in the month of March, and we've got a link up on our webpage for more details. Joy, thanks very much for dropping by. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. We invite you to check us out online at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, it's another side effect of rising interest rates. The number of loan approvals have been cut in half since the Fed's first rate hike. What will be the longer-term impact, and will that trend reverse itself as those rates come back down? So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.